Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session. Pursuant to law.
Thank you. At this time, we're on record in Noel versus the City of Rigby. Here for oral argument on behalf of the appellant, City of Rigby, Sam Angel. Will argue, and on behalf of the respondent, Paul Zeal, will argue. Are there any preliminary matters by either party?
I'm not aware of any either, Your Honor. If it is appropriate, I'd like maybe introduce my clients to the court at this time. Peter and Elisa Noel are here, the parents of Shaylee Noel, and she's here as well.
Very good. So, thank you.
Welcome.
Any other matters, sir?
No, I proceed.
We'll proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, it's always an honor to be able to appear and offer oral argument before the court. My name is Sam Angel. I do represent the City of Rigby. This case arises out of an accident that occurred on February 7, 2015, where Shaylee Noel was injured on a two-crawl structure at the City of Rigby city park called South Park. We tried this case to a jury. The jury returned a verdict in favor of the City of Rigby, and this is important. On the special verdict form, the jury stopped on the first question, which was the question, did the City of Rigby owe Shaylee a duty? And answered that question, no. 11 of the 12 jurors signed off on that verdict. Following trial, so the jury did not reach any of the questions on negligence, causation, or damages. Following trial, plaintiffs made a motion for a JNOV and a new trial, and Judge Stevens granted the motion for the new trial. And so we have filed an appeal, and the primary basis for my argument today, and I want to start with this, is Judge Stevens' decision to grant the motion for the new trial. I understand that I'm before this court on an abuse of discretion standard, and that's a little bit difficult for me to argue. But I think that this case is the case that this court needs to take a real careful look at as to whether or not Judge Stevens abused his discretion in granting the new trial. So to start with, I want to direct the court right to the standard on a motion for a new trial. And this court has iterated that standard very clearly, what a district judge must analyze when looking at the issue of whether or not to grant a new trial. There's a two-part analysis. This is outlined ages ago in Blaine versus Byers and more recently in other cases. The first prong of that analysis is important. The court must find that the verdict is against the clear weight of evidence and that the ends of justice would be served by vacating the verdict. So to begin with, Judge Stevens issued a written decision on the motion for the new trial. It has a section that talks about the first element, where he discusses whether or not the verdict was against the clear weight of evidence. And I want to start with that. There was evidence in this case to support the jury's verdict as to whether or not there was a duty owed by the City of Rigby. And we have to talk about what the duty was in this case.
Isn't the question of duty normally, though, a question of law? Right. When do we ever ask a jury whether there's a duty in a negligence case? I understand why we're there here, but isn't normally the question of duty an application of legal principles rather than factual ones for juries to decide case by case?
Well, not always. I get that can happen at times. But I think in this case where we're dealing with the trespasser standard, and the trespasser standard requires that a government entity in this case know or reasonably should have known or reasonably anticipated that a trespasser would have been on the property before they owe a duty to that person. So I think the court can establish what the rule is on the duty that is owed, and that would be the duty established under the trespasser standard, and Judge Stevens got that right. But there was a factual question about whether or not the city knew or reasonably anticipated a trespasser, a child, being on this playground equipment in the wintertime.
Wouldn't it have been better, though, if the jury had a special verdict form that asked the question that way, rather than asking whether or not there was a duty, asking whether or not the person was a trespasser that could have been reasonably anticipated. Was it or not a failure in how the verdict form was prepared?
Oh, great question. The special verdict form has a general statement of was there a duty. The special question or the instructions sent to the jury are very particular in describing to analyze duty. This is what you look at. You look at and it broke that right down for the jury. So they would have known what they had to analyze to be able to reach the decision of whether or not the city owed Shaley a duty.
But it sounds like they're being asked to draw in the special verdict form the legal conclusion rather than making the factual finding that we usually require of a jury. Shouldn't there have been a special verdict form asking them to make a factual finding rather than asking them to make a legal conclusion?
Well, that's a good question. I think we can always look back at that. I think that it does when it outlines what the standard is on duty. The jury had to go through the instruction which said, you know, did the city know or reasonably anticipate that a person would be on the property? If yes, you answer it this way. And so I think that the jury was properly instructed. I don't think that issue has been challenged on appeal. And so we have to assume that the jury would have understood. They are making a factual finding of whether or not the city of Rigby would have understood or reasonably anticipated that a child would be in there on this playground equipment. And so,
so the fact that the special verdict says, did the city owe a duty to Shaley, you think that's a question of fact that they're being asked to answer?
Well, I guess...
The city owed Shaley a duty. Whether they knew she was likely to be on that equipment at that time is a different question, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I hadn't thought about that until now, but I think if the court looks at the instructions given to the jury, you will see that the jury would have understood or been instructed that to answer that question, you look at the actual factual finding. Does that make sense?
You're arguing that we need to take the instructions as a whole and not just focus on the verdict.
Exactly. Right. And I think that's standard for district judges to give to put a question on the verdict form that summarizes what the question is with a more specific instruction that instructs the jury on how to analyze the facts and law on that point. So I think the jury was properly instructed on it. I don't think that's been challenged. I think the issue was that we got off track with Judge Stevens when he went back and reviewed that and had to make a finding that that verdict was against the clear weight of the evidence. If we assume that the jury was properly instructed and that hasn't been challenged, then Judge Stevens needed to have made a factual finding, having reviewed the credibility of the witness testimony, that it was against the clear weight of evidence, and simply wasn't.
Isn't that implicit in his decision?
Well, I don't know if it is or not, because he doesn't discuss it. He doesn't discuss the witnesses. He doesn't discuss the credibility of the witnesses. He gives about a one-paragraph analysis of the fact that the park was closed, but it wasn't gated off. People could walk in, and there had been some testimony of an adult walking around the walking path. I think it's important to understand what this park included when you get into Judge Stevens' analysis. He said, well, the fact that it wasn't roped off and that there had been an older couple walking their dog around the walking path is evidence enough to suggest that the city could have reasonably anticipated that Shaley would be in the park. This park included a walking path. It included a separate area with some baseball fields. It included another separate area with some playground equipment on the grass. It was adjacent to the rodeo grounds and had access there. So there were multiple parts to this park. And there was testimony, ample testimony in this record, that no one had ever seen a child playing on the playground equipment ever during the winter closure. There was not a fact in the record that that had ever happened.
Was there testimony there actually was a closure? I know the judge made some comment that there was no ordinance passed to close the park. There was some kind of closure of the parking lot to keep cars from driving through. Was there a closure truly, or was that testimony given in the record that this was closed, this park was off limits?
Yes, there was testimony from the mayor and also from the police officers that they did a winter closure. They indicated that by closing the driving gates and putting up a park closed sign at the primary access where you drive in. Ramiro Hernandez, who took Shaley to the park that day, parked in front of that sign and testified that he saw the park closed sign, but they walked around it and went through one of the walk paths and got into the park.
But isn't the park closed in the winter to protect the irrigation equipment that's in the park and not to prevent people from going there when there isn't snow?
That was one of the reasons, yes. Mr. Lamoureux, the Public Works Director, testified that that was one of the reasons the park was closed, correct. And so when you take that all together, the question is, did the jury have a factual basis to make a finding that the city would not have reasonably anticipated that a child would be playing on the playground equipment? There was evidence to support that. And Judge Stevens, by looking at it and deciding, well, I think the park wasn't gated off and closed off and blocked off, therefore they could have reasonably anticipated I'm going to substitute out my decision for the jury, got outside of what the weight of the testimony was at trial. And he simply substituted his opinion on that issue.
But how do we substitute our opinion for his? I mean, he sat through the entire trial. And so when you're, it sounds like you're essentially asking us to reweigh the testimony of all these witnesses when we weren't there.
Right, and that's difficult for this court. I understand that. But that what this court has to do is look to see if Judge Stevens made a finding based upon the facts that there was a reason to get away from the jury verdict. What did he point to on the facts in his decision that would justify his decision to undo the jury verdict?
So you're saying
it's the lack of his analysis, really, and lack of his pointing to facts and witnesses that would give this court the ability to say, no, we need to uphold this jury verdict.
Would we uphold it, or would we send it back for him to try again if it's inadequate findings?
Right. I think this court should reverse, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, the district judge has a duty to, he has a responsibility. It says he must analyze this evidence. If he doesn't, then there is not a basis to grant the new trial, and that should simply be reversed. Second reason for that is more practical. 8 days after this decision was issued on the motion for new trial, I received a notice in my email box that Judge Stevens was retiring and that they were taking applicants for the position. And Judge Stevens is now retired and is off the bench. Judge Thompson has been appointed to fill that position. I think it would be nearly impossible practically to have this sent back for further analysis because I don't know where Judge Stevens is at or if he's available.
He's a senior judge, is he not?
I'm not sure.
He's
honestly
probably on the Salmon River right now.
Maybe it's our weed track down. Anyway, so I think it should be reversed. I want to get to the second prong because I feel like there's an even bigger issue with the second prong of this analysis. The second prong.
Before we get there, could I just ask one last question about credibility? Because you really put a lot of your briefing on the issue of credibility.
Yes.
You sat through the trial, as did Mr. Zeal. If the issue of credibility was so important, what evidence can you point to that would have given reasons for the judge to find that the plaintiff's witnesses on the issue of duty weren't credible?
Well, I...
Because obviously the jury believed your witnesses and not their witnesses. He's thinking that the jury, if they had looked at the evidence fairly, would have believed the plaintiff's witnesses. Is that a wrong analysis?
Not necessarily, and maybe credibility is the wrong emphasis. I think it's simply the lack of evidence of notice of people being in that park.
I mean, did you attack the credibility of the plaintiff's witnesses in regards to that issue?
Sure. We questioned every single one of them if they had ever seen anybody in this park, specifically if they had seen any children.
But other than disagreeing with you, was there anything about their testimony that would have made it incredible, like bias or some kind of impeachment mode that would have applied?
Well, I don't know that I can necessarily say that other than two of their witnesses were the parents. One of the other witnesses was the guardian that was there with her, Mr. Hernandez. And so I think that they have some incentive to imply that there should be a duty. But no, I mean, they testified and they were pressed on the issue of whether or not they knew of anybody being in the park in the wintertime, and they could
but
see
their
that they're
credibility happy. Wasn't assailed because of lack of foundation or because they had bad eyesight or anything like that.
Not that I recall, no. So moving to the second prong, and this is important. The second aspect in this court has held that district judges must conclude that a retrial would produce a different result. This is particularly problematic. Judge Stevens issued a one-sentence decision on this issue, on this prong. His one sentence was this: the court also finds where the evidence was presented at trial that would allow a reasonable jury to find that the city engaged in willful, wanton, or reckless conduct, that a retrial would likely produce a different result. Judge Stevens analyzed the negligence breach section, not the duty section, when he was looking at the second prong of this analysis. The jury decided this solely on duty.
If the judge is going to say, I think there needs to be a retrial, he needs to analyze why he thinks there would be a different result on a retrial on the issue of duty, on the notice aspect of it.
But he issued an opinion that it was against the clear weight of the evidence. So why are we focusing on that?
That it was against the clear weight of the evidence?
That the jury's determination on duty was against the clear weight of the evidence. So, I mean, on the interests of justice prong, I mean, why are we back focusing on that? He's already said...
Because it's a two-part analysis. It's first, is it against the clear weight of evidence? And the second element, the court must also conclude that a retrial would reach a different result. I would expect to see a district judge saying, if we try this again, and the jury focuses on witness 1, 2, and 3 that talked about this aspect of notice and whether or not children were in the park, a second jury is going to reach the right conclusion that the city knew or should have known. I would expect to see that fact-by-fact detailed analysis from the district judge who sat and listened to every witness. That's the purpose. This is a gatekeeper role that the district judge is engaging in, to make sure that juries don't get all sorts of off the track. But here we had 12 jurors in Jefferson County. This was a good jury. I remember sitting down in the trial thinking, there's a lot of moms and grandparents on this jury that are going to feel bad for Shaley. This is a pretty good plaintiff's jury. And 12 jurors sat and listened to this trial, and 11 of them agreed that there was not a duty.
And how often do you think we see a district judge say that, I think a new trial should be granted?
I have no idea.
Rarely. So we look at it as if the person who was there, who has been invested with determining whether justice was done, says, was justice done? And he didn't think that was. So how do we then say Judge Stevens was wrong?
And I respect that. And I'm going to say this next part in a soft voice because I like Judge Stevens. I clerked for him in 2002 at his law firm. When he made that analysis on the second prong, and when he said, I believe that he didn't meet the reckless requirement, he reiterated a statement he had made earlier to us on the record in the trial. I'm going to read you two quotes made by him at the close of plaintiff's case when we were discussing the motion for directed verdict. Quote, my personal opinion, that's reckless, end quote. Quote, I'd say the city was reckless in the way they constructed those things, end quote. I believe Judge Stevens had a bias. We all approach trials with our own bias. We bring it with us. My partner Blake Hall and I joked after that day, I'm glad Al's not on the jury, because we're going to lose this if he is. But he ended up being the jury in this case, and I don't think that the evidence supported that. I believe he had a bias that he thought the tubes were recklessly built. They might have been.
How is it biased if a judge has formed an opinion based upon hearing some of the evidence? Granted, he needs to hear all of the evidence, but there was a motion before him for a directed verdict after the plaintiff rested, so he should have some opinion at that point. Why does that make one biased if he's formed an opinion when you're asking him to rule based on that opinion?
Yeah.
Because if he has felt like it wasn't reckless, he would have told you, oh, I don't think this was reckless, I'm going to grant your motion. Then we'd have Mr. Zeal in here saying, oh, that was a biased judge because he had an opinion.
Well, it was the close of the plaintiff's case. We hadn't put our evidence on yet. He hadn't heard our side of the story. He had only heard the plaintiff's expert. And it just caused me to think, but the thing is, there is an important aspect that this court has to consider, and that's the sanctity of jury verdicts. And it's also a second policy consideration is the trespasser standard. What are we going to require cities and private landowners to do when they're making their premises available to trespassers? They're not fencing them out and throwing up gates and bolts and chains. There's a limited duty that we require private landowners and public entities to offer to a trespasser. And it's important under that standard that we only hold them to the new or should have known, what they reasonably could have anticipated people doing on that property. And that's why it's important that when the jury in this case found that the city just didn't know that a child was going to be in there playing on the playground equipment, that we don't force them to be responsible for the second part of the analysis, were they reckless in what they were doing.
Is the standard different if it had happened in the summer and the park had been open?
Yes, I think it would have been different.
What's the standard under those circumstances?
Because they may have been an invitee in that standard.
You were successful on summary judgment in throwing out the attractive nuisance
correct.
cause of action.
Correct.
Do you think that there was any application of that doctrine if it had been in the summer as under Justice Stegner's hypothetical?
I'd have to think that through. It would certainly be different if it's open to the public. We know children are in there every day playing, and we're closely monitoring it. It's a different situation in the summertime. Let me give you a different example that I think is important, and it's this. In this case, had the evidence at trial been that in the wintertime, our public works director, Mitch Bradley, decided, I've got to rip out a section of that walking path to pull out a sewer line that's bad. And he gets the backhoe, digs a four-foot trench, and rips out a section of that walking path, and then throws a tarp over it to cover it for the night. When he knows that there's a little old lady walking her dog around that walking path in the wintertime, she's a trespasser, he would have known, at that point, he knew that someone was walking around the path, and he should have been careful to not leave a dangerous condition on that path. That would have been different under the notice requirement. But here we have a situation where there is absolutely no notice of any children on the different part of the park on the playground equipment. And it's important as a policy consideration that we not put more onus on the landowner than what notice would give them.
Do we know from the record how much snow was on the ground at the time of the incident? I know in a typical winter in February in Rigby, there's probably going to be 3 or 4 feet of snow, and there's not going to be a lot of children playing on the equipment.
No, it was a nice day.
If it was a nice day without a lot of snow, wouldn't it have been more reasonable for the city to expect children if we were having a light winter versus a typical winter?
Didn't the photos in the record suggest that there wasn't any snow?
Right, that's fair. It was a nice day, and I don't think there was any snow in the park. That's why they've gone. But on that point, if we're going to say if it's just a nice day that is notice, then all of a sudden we're putting all public and private landowners on notice of trespassers for all purposes on the property. And I feel like that's opening a big door for the duty to go out and monitor and check everything on the trespasser standard.
I'm just trying to picture the difference between a nice day in February and a nice day in July.
I mean, it would still be significantly different. I mean, even if the sun was shining in Rigby in February, I mean, it would be cold, but you're not trudging through snow. I think the testimony was there was not snow on the ground.
Right. I'm trying to figure out the legal difference between a nice day in February and a nice day in January, as far as children accessing a park.
Yeah. I just think that it's not enough to put a city on notice that children are going to be in there. And so I do think that on those two points, that this one was in error, and that it's appropriate for this court to make sure that on the new trial, that we're only using this mechanism when we truly have a jury verdict that's gone astray. And that here there's evidence that Judge Stevens simply did not analyze the correct standard. He didn't get to the second prong at all. That is an abuse of discretion. And we have a suggestion that he may have substituted his own bias by his statement that he made, and that's really what drove it 8 days before retirement. Anyway, any other questions? I'd like to reserve my time to respond to you. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the respondent.
Thank you, Chief Justice Burdick. May it please the court and counsel, and as counsel expressed, it is really an honor to be in front of this body. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I thought it might be appropriate for me to give this court just a really quick roadmap of where I'm going. I know the court can and will ask me questions, and I look forward to that, but just in the time I have allotted, I have quite a bit to cover. So just so the court knows where I'm going, and if the court wants to go a different direction, that's fine. Obviously, I need to address this issue that has been brought up on appeal, which is whether there should have been a directed verdict granted, whether it was appropriate for the new trial to be granted. I also want to go into one of the issues I brought up on appeal, which is I think there was an irregularity in this particular case where the judge chose not to grant a new trial based on that, and I want to address that briefly. And then, assuming that this court does uphold the district court, I would also like to address some of the issues I brought up on cross-appeal that I think made this case very difficult for me to try, and it's part of the reason why I think we got an unreasonable result from the jury. And those include things like the not being able to present unadjusted medical bills, the situation where we had willful and wanton conduct by the city, and then they were allowed to have an instruction with comparative negligence than a simple negligence. And to me, that's comparing apples and oranges, and I want to address that. And then there's been some issues regarding the expert and seasonal closure that I'm going to try to get into if I have time. So my argument's fairly simple in responding to counsel's argument about whether there should have been a new trial. Well, actually, I'd like to start, if I could, with the directed verdict. Let's start where in chronological order. As I've looked at this, it appears to me that there's the Irish decision, 163 Idaho, and the pinpoint sites at 110. And the standard for a directed verdict is whether evidence is so clear that all reasonable minds could reach only one conclusion. And I think it's really important that I talk to this court about what I think the status of the evidence was at the time they moved for the directed verdict and why it was appropriate for the lower court not to grant that directed verdict. One of the reasons why I'm asking for attorney fees is I don't think that the city of Rigby has appropriately brought up all the facts that had been brought up in the plaintiff's case in chief. And I want to go over some of those for a moment, if I may. First of all, in the plaintiff's case in chief, I think almost without exception, probably without exception, every party that took the stand had been out to that park, and almost without exception, every party talked about how there was at least one opening into the park, if not multiple openings. And I think, case in point, Rick Lamoureux, who was in charge of the parks, testified that there was an entrance over on the street called Third West. There was an entrance that had a straight line towards the playground, and there was also an entrance through the baseball diamonds that people could go into the park. So you have him talking about that and talking about how there's a path that goes around, and he acquiesced that that path goes in fairly near proximity to the playground. You had Peter Noel, who's not only the father of Shaley, but he was a former Rigby police officer who was charged with patrolling this park, and he was aware of this alleged closure, and I'm going into that in a little bit. And he talked about the openings. And not to beat a dead horse, but Lisa Noel took the stand and talked about it. Shaley talked about how she just walked in that day. There was an emergency responder, Jeanette Anderson, who said that. The expert witness, Scott Burton, after having reviewed all the depositions and all the pictures, talked about how he could just walk in. Spencer Housley, who was the law enforcement officer who responded to the scene that day when she suffered her horrific injuries, said you could walk right in. And I think I've made the point, but the bottom line is, it was wide open. The only thing that was closed, and this was clear when the plaintiffs ended closed their case in chief, is they had just shut one gate so you couldn't go in with vehicles, and Rick Lamoureux testified it so the irrigation equipment wouldn't get damaged. I think it's also important to kind of move on with some of the other evidence as to why I think directed verdict would have been inappropriate. You had Rick Lamoureux testifying that there had been vandalism in the park. If there's vandalism in the park, they obviously knew people were going in and that they were accessing the park. And it's the city's trying to say, well, we've never seen a child in the park. But the standard here is whether they knew or reasonably could have anticipated children in the park. If you know there's a walking path that goes right past the playground, and you know that there's vandalism occurring in the park, they could reasonably anticipate the children would be in the park.
Counsel, I'm trying to understand how the issue of duty actually was decided by the jury in the first place. You heard our questions to your opposing counsel on that matter. They moved for summary judgment on the issue of duty, and the judge denied that. I'm wondering why you didn't move for summary judgment on that issue and try to take that issue away from the trial and home.
So I'm due to be candid with the court. What I don't recall exactly how it went down. You know, you review, and there's a lot of paperwork to this case, as the court's aware. And I don't recall reviewing that in preparing for this. I recall being concerned about it, but I cannot stand here in front of this court today as an officer of the court and say whether I had objected on record or not. I don't remember. I should have, in hindsight, it's 20-20, because I think it's a legal issue.
Well, I was looking at your objection to the defendant's motion for summary judgment, and you responded to that by arguing that there are general questions of material fact on the issue of whether or not the child was a trespasser or not. So by conceding that, doesn't that undermine your argument now that a reasonable view of the facts, that there's no reasonable view of the facts that could have supported the jury's verdict?
I don't think it does undermine my argument, because when you look at the standard for direct verdict that I'm talking about, it's whether the evidence is so clear that all reasonable minds could reach only one conclusion. And what I'm walking the court through right now, I think at a minimum at least keeps a material question of fact open, and I think it was appropriate for the judge not to take away the issue from the jury at the time of direct verdict. So I want to answer the court's question directly. Is that
I guess what I'm getting at, though, is that the summary judgment phase, you were basically saying, hey, this is a jury question. We'll let the jury decide it. Well, they did. And you didn't like it, and the judge didn't like it. But the jury apparently reached a conclusion, and you concluded that it was, I mean, usually on summary judgment we say, well, if it's a genuine issue of material fact, we're going to let the jury decide. And they did decide.
I see what the court's saying here, but I think when you get on to the next standard that you talk about, which is the granting the new trial, though, I don't think that's incompatible, because I was saying, okay, let's put it in front of the jury, and I may not like the result of the jury, but here's the thing. The evidence that came out, I think, is unreasonable. I was saying pre-trial, hey, let's put the facts on the record and see what comes of it. And then post-trial, when the record had come out, we knew that there was this path that was wide open. Kids walked past it. We knew that there had been vandalism in the park. We knew, and some of the things that ended up happening when I got the new trial, and Judge Stevens referred to this, we even found out at trial that Mitch Bradley, who was one of the employees, knew that there were people walking in the park and knew the names of the people walking in the park. And so, to answer the court's question directly, maybe it sounds like I'm trying to have my cake and eat it too, but I don't think that's the case. I was just saying pre-trial, let's reserve it and see what the jury says. And post-trial, when you look at the duty that was owed, which is whether they knew or reasonably could have anticipated, I think there's only one way that the jury could have gone. If the jury had gone beyond that and maybe had decided this case on something else, I may not be able to stand here today. But the fact that they didn't get past that threshold issue tells me that this jury just wasn't, they just weren't checked in with it. I think Judge Stevens was absolutely right to determine, and by the way, when you look at his decision, I think it's implied that he weighed the evidence, and I will acknowledge there wasn't a lot of analysis there, but he did come to the conclusion after weighing the evidence that no reasonable, or that there would be a different result. And I think that is the case when you look at all the things I'm talking about. I don't know how a reasonable person can come to the conclusion that you wouldn't anticipate a child being in there when we're talking about the fact pattern we're talking about. It's just, it's not believable to me. It's not credible. So does that answer the court's question?
It does. I guess the point I'm trying to make is it appears that the plaintiffs made a tactical choice not to file a cross motion for summary judgment, because it was your position, let's let the jury decide. Well, you talk about eating cake. I'm not an expert on cake. That's not true. Maybe I am. But
listen, I've seen him in chambers. Yes.
But it just seems like you made a tactical decision, and we're going to let's let the jury decide it. I can hear you arguing that to the judge. The jury should decide this. And they did decide it. So why do you get a do-over?
Well, I'm probably just sounding like a robot and repeating myself, but I stand by this answer, Justice Mullen, and I believe it's appropriate. I think pre-trial, I was saying, well, it's a question of fact. You know, in hindsight, I'm not sure my legal analysis was correct. It's probably a question of law. But that's what I said. That's what I put on the record. Post-trial, after the evidence came out, to me, when you look at the standard we're dealing with, to me, Judge Stevens made the only, I probably should refer to the lower court, the district court made the only decision I think you could make based on the evidence. So I understand where you're going. I think it's an excellent question. I just think that it's different once the evidence came out. That's the clearest answer I can give. I think
Maybe just a couple other things I'm going to talk about at this point, and then I'm going to move on. Of course, I'll take any questions the court has. And this really goes to both the question of whether there should have been a directed verdict and also on a new trial. When you're looking at all the evidence, I do want to point out, and I apologize, I don't have the citation to the record, but I do in my briefing. But I think it's also important, Scott Burton testified that there wasn't clear signage saying that the park was closed. I also think it's important, as this court's alluded to in its questioning to opposing counsel, that there wasn't a clear policy. When you go through and you examine the record here, the mayor is saying one thing, the law enforcement saying another, the Parks and Recreation saying something totally different, and the mayor very, and I think this is important on the new trial issue, the mayor made it really clear in the testimony, there's not even ordinance that has ever been passed saying that the park was closed. And so there's not a clear policy, there's no ordinance justifying this theory that it's closed, and I just think it's a strange. Moving on, I have to rely almost exclusively on my briefing on the irregularity because I filed that under seal. I think it was appropriate to file it under seal. I think the court would agree after having read it. But I do just want to put on the record and submit, I do think that that needs a second look because, and again, I think the briefing lays this out pretty clearly, but as I mentioned, that jury was out for a while, and to opposing counsel's credit, it was Mr. Hall who remembered. Mr. Hall said, hey, we accidentally put in the unredacted counseling records. We got to get that out. And I think that showed integrity on his part. We tried to get a hold of the judge. We couldn't do it. A lot of time passed. Finally, the judge authorized it to come out when we're 40, 50 minutes into deliberation. And I could be off on the timing, but that's what my recollection tells me. And we take that out, and within minutes, a verdict comes back.
Counsel, I'm trying to understand on this argument, though, as you develop it here on your cross-appeal. Let's assume the jury saw what they shouldn't have seen.
Right.
And I'm not, certainly it was embarrassing information. I'm not sure whether it would have prejudiced the jury against your client or not, where she was just a witness to the incidents recorded there and wasn't involved in it. But assuming the worst, that they were somehow prejudiced, they never made a decision where that prejudice would be manifest, did they? The issue of duty had nothing to do with the issue that the prejudice might have been applied to later on, like, for example, her damages and the psychological effects, the mental anguish and those type of things. I could see your argument if it was being applied to a verdict in that area, but where the verdict was just on the issue of duty, how does that even come into play here?
Excellent question, and I'm going to start out by conceding. I think that your question's correct. I think legally those are two different things. And I think I, as an officer of the court, probably have to acknowledge to this court that I am making a little bit of a leap, and I think I even said that in my briefing, because we don't know what the jury did. But I think it does dovetail into one of the arguments that I'm going to make, is the way that special verdict form was laid out. They may not have ever been able to get all the way through that form, but I think it is a critical issue because a major issue at this trial that showed up on the form was whether my client, Peter Noel, was negligent in allowing his daughter, Shaylee Noel, to go to the park, and whether Romero Hernandez was negligent in supervising her. And so the credibility of the parents had absolutely been put into play here. Legally, they don't match up. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like your question isn't valid because, to be honest, legally, I think you're 100% correct. And whether this holds any weight or not, I don't know if I'm going to say it. We all know that juries do. We don't know why juries come to decisions they do. I revere juries. I respect their service. All of us believe in it or we wouldn't be here. But sometimes juries do strange things. And maybe I'm making a leap, but I want to put it on the record that I think that irregularity was a big deal in light of the fact that they were, that the Peter Noel's competence or, you know, alleged negligence was a huge factor in this case. So Judge, or Justice Mueller, I think your point's well taken. I concede it, but I do think that that was planted in the jury's mind and it shouldn't have been. So that's as simple and as plain as I can make that argument. If I may, and of course I would entertain any questions as we go, I think that pretty much covers where I'm at on the new trial. I'm probably going to pivot to the rest of the issues. But, and I would just ask, I referred to it in my briefing, I tried pretty hard to make sure that the transcript goes back to all the pieces of evidence. And so I think when the court looks at that, you'll see that there was plenty of evidence to support what the judge did, the lower court judge. The next thing I want to come to, and I have a feeling that this is probably something this court wants to address, is I want to talk a little bit about the unadjusted medical bills.
Well, Mr. Zeal, is that issue preserved? I mean, in reading Mr. Angel's brief, it suggests that you tried the case on pain and suffering alone and not on the medical bills themselves. And so I'm wondering if it's been preserved.
Thank you for asking that question, Justice Stegner. I believe it is preserved, and I did review the cases as I was required under court order. I cannot remember what case it was, but there is a specific case that I cite to in my brief that talks about if you bring it up in pretrial motions, that it's preserved. And I did do an extensive motion in limine. I briefed this. I don't remember how many pages my brief was, but it was extensive. I went into this court's Diet decision, the Verska decision, and I did a very extensive analysis. And the lower court judge found that, and I know this court's aware of it, but the lower court judge determined that he would not allow the unadjusted bills to come in. And then his exact ruling, as I recall, is he said, this isn't quite a quote, but it's almost a quote, he said, only what the Noels paid for out of pocket. That's what I think he said, something along those lines. And to the best of my recollection, what they owed out of pocket was $400. So I suppose I'm not going to necessarily concede it, but I could think there's probably an argument that maybe I didn't preserve $400. But I think the remaining amount I have preserved because the judge made it really clear in the motion in limine, I can't bring it in. And
just so I understand, I mean, are you saying you had to make a tactical decision when the unadjusted medical bills were not allowed in, and your tactical decision was, I'm going to go with nothing. I'm better off arguing no bills rather than $400 worth of bills.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, Justice Brody, I appreciate that you brought that up. I felt, based on his ruling, I was down to $400. And I made the decision, right or wrong, I could have been wrong, but I made the decision that if I were to put $400 worth of damages in front of that jury, it underappreciates the severe nature of what she went through. And if I may elaborate on your question just a little bit further, this isn't a jury, and I think it's inappropriate for me to try to appeal to emotions, but this court does need to know, we're talking about a 9-year-old girl who had her gums debuffed, completely ripped off above the front teeth. She suffered multiple abrasions, neck injuries. It was a horrific injury. And I felt tactically that if I were to go in and ask for $400 in damages, it was a joke. And I just felt like the jury wouldn't I just felt like the case was dead at that point. Again, I could have been wrong, Justice Brody. I don't know, hindsight's 20/20, but I felt like I didn't really have a choice at that point. And if I can just make a plea to this court, I think that this case is the perfect case to decide what, at least maybe us as practitioners are getting it wrong, but a lot of us in the bar feel like this court has some inconsistencies between Verska and Diet, and I know there was even an Idaho State Advocate article on that. I'm sure this court's aware of it. Again, it's possible I'm not reading those cases right, and maybe they're consistent with each other, but as a practitioner, I don't find them consistent. And I think that this is an opportunity
for this court to make it really clear that what I would suggest is you adopt Diet. By the way, I think the collateral doctrine rule, that's legislated. We have to follow it. I'm not suggesting we get rid of that. But I think we just make it clear when it comes to the issue of unadjusted medical bills, we allow it to come in, and this is the case in point, why they should come in. All of our district court judges, without exception, I mean, I haven't appeared in every in front of every one of them, but I've appeared in front of a lot. They are all excellent judges. They're all capable of putting together special verdict forms that would allow for the, they can make it really clear how much is apportioned to the medical bills. And then once we've done that, if the jury comes back and they apportion X amount, we can see that they apportion too much. The judge can issue a remitter. It's no big deal. But I think the way that Judge Stevens did it, and the district court judge, I just think it was confusing, and it left me in a situation where I didn't feel like I had a choice. So that would be my answer to your question, Justice Brody. I hope that answers it. That's what I have on that. I know this court's well-versed on those decisions. I wanted to share as a practitioner what the effect of that was for me, though, and why I think it created and really put me in an unfair, put my client in an unfair spot. And I think that the case law is similar. There's similar experiences to mine. There's a couple other things I want to go into if I have time. The next thing I want to talk about is this issue with comparative negligence. And if I may, I am going to expand a little bit more beyond my briefing, because I don't know that this came out very well. But I'm going to share with this court what I think my understanding is of the different levels of negligence. We all know there's simple negligence. All of us understand that. That's law school 101. And then we know that in Idaho we have case law, we have statutes, we have jury instructions that talks about gross negligence and negligence that comes along with intentional torts. And I think that's another level. But I would submit there's a third level, and that's willful and wanton conduct. That's what we have here today. And in this particular case, the district court judge stated that he took the Roush decision, and I think the Roush decision, if I'm reading it correctly, is dealing with gross negligence. It's dealing with an intentional tort, and in that case, the court allowed comparative negligence. I think the court was correct in doing that.
So you think gross negligence and intentional negligence are synonymous?
Essentially, I think they are, Justice Steger, I think they're, obviously there's some difference there, but I think they fall in that same category. They'd both be put under, in fact, I think I put it in here, the Idaho Model Jury Instruction 2.24, I think they both probably fall under that. Now, are they synonymous? Probably not 100%. I think legally we know there's some difference between intentional tort and gross negligence, and there can be different facts. But it is my submission to this court that they are different. They are the same in terms of the way we treat them for comparative negligence purposes. So, yeah, I would say they're the same for that. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
It answers my question.
Okay.
I'm not sure that I concur that gross negligence is intentional, but I understand your position.
Okay, thank you. And again, I think they're two separate things, but I think they're treated the same way under the IGI is what I'm trying to say.
Well, whether they should be is a different question.
That is a different question. I'm not sure that's before this court, and I'm not sure they should be, but I believe they are.
Well, I think the question of whether we, if we remand and give the new trial judge instructions, whether comparative negligence should be weighed against a reckless or wanton and willful standard is very much at play.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure that question has been answered clearly.
Well, I'm going to make an attempt to do that. I think when you look at the Hodge and Loomis decisions, and I understand that was before the comparative negligence statute was enacted, but I think those are good law, and my reading of those decisions is that that's comparing apples and oranges, and they shouldn't be compared with each other.
And I would submit, Justice Stegner, that when you're dealing with willful and wanton conduct, that is different than dealing with the gross negligence. I mean, they're different issues. They have different analyses. So I think, I believe that it was inappropriate for us to try to compare those two things. One of the arguments I make is the city of Rigby was afforded the absolute highest level of protection they could be afforded civilly. They literally had to, the standard, as this court's well aware, but I think I'm going to read it, is it's more than ordinary negligence. It's intentional or reckless actions taken under circumstances where the actor knew or should have known the actions not only created an unreasonable risk of harm to another, but involved a high degree of probability that such harm would actually result. It reminds me, and now I'm comparing apples to oranges, but it kind of reminds me of the criminal system and the burden of proof there, where you have to find beyond a reasonable doubt. It seems like this is the absolute highest level. And it felt to me, going back to the analogy of having your cake and eating it too, I don't see how you can compare Peter Noel allowing his daughter to go to park on a sunny day and Mr. Hernandez supervising a child on a sunny day in a park, this alleged negligence, compared to maintaining what we believe was maintaining equipment in a manner that was likely to cause great harm. I don't think it was fair, and I think it put the Noels at a disadvantage right from the shoe. So I don't think that comparative negligence should have been allowed in this case.
But do you have any post Hodge and Loomis cases that shed light on the comparison of negligence with recklessness?
I don't, Your Honor, and I believe, part of me thinks that's one of the reasons why this court wanted to take this up. I think it's a good opportunity for this court to address this particular issue. I think it needs addressed, and I believe this is an opportunity to accomplish what I'm asking to happen here, which is to treat this, to say when you have willful and wanton conduct, you can't have comparative negligence to simple negligence. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, what if you frame the question, though, in terms of fault? Who is at fault for Shaley's injuries? And that fault can take various forms. I don't care what legal label you put to it, but the idea of asking a jury to say, who's responsible? I mean, why is that so offensive?
Well, I guess it comes back to the argument I just made. I feel that when you have willful and wanton conduct, you're afforded the absolute highest level. And I'm trying not to repeat myself, but it's such a high burden for a plaintiff to overcome and to meet. I feel if you can meet that, then there shouldn't be any comparative negligence unless we're talking about willful and wanton conduct on the other side. I think that your question is a good question, but I think it comes down to the burden of proof, and I just think it's a high, high bar. And I think that it's unfair to plaintiffs to have to do that when we're talking about apples and oranges. So I understand the question. I just think the burden of proof is too high.
If there's a problem here, is it with the statute? And are we trying to solve something that really is the legislature's province? I'm referring to 6801.
This court, so first of all, I would never suggest that this court go against the legislature, and I know this court's very good at not doing that. As I read the statute, though, I believe that there is some room for this court to interpret, and I think it's appropriate for this court to interpret that you can't compare, like I keep saying, apples and oranges.
Well, 6801 mentions gross negligence, right?
Yes, it does.
It doesn't mention the type of negligence, the willful and wanton that you're arguing in this case. Did the legislature leave that out intentionally, or was it an oversight? Do we have any reason to believe they didn't know what they were doing when they wrote the statute the way they did?
Again, as an officer of the court, I don't know the answer to that, and so I'm going to have to just say I don't know, Your Honor. So I am out of time. Of course, I take any questions the court has.
Fair to be known. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How much time does the appellant have?
8 minutes,
Your
Honor.
Sir?
Thank you. I want to just pull the court.
court back to the issue that I feel like needs to be decided first, and that's on the motion for the new trial. I want to reemphasize a piece of case law that I did not quote directly earlier on the second prong of the analysis on the motion for retrial, and that is this court decided in the Blizzard case, when considering a motion for a new trial pursuant to Rule 59, in deciding whether a different result would be obtained at a new trial, the judge must consider whether it is more probable than not that a different or more favorable result, as rendered by the questions the jury answered and only those questions the jury answered, would be obtained at a new trial. This is the key analysis in this case. And when Judge Stevens got to that point, he didn't talk about the question the jury decided the case on duty. And that was the abuse of discretion. And when this court sits and looks at it, if we uphold the motion for the new trial, we're sending this back to trial on what? It is going to have the same evidence, the same witnesses will testify, the same exhibits will be offered, we will have testimony about the same park closure, the same open entrances, the same no children ever being seen in the park, the same couple walking the dog around the walking path. And we've already had a jury decide that was not enough to put the city on notice that there would be a child trespassing in the playground area. In order for this court to uphold Judge Stevens, he would have needed to analyze the facts and find that it's more probable than not, based on his view of what those witnesses said, that a different jury is going to reach a different result. He would have had to say, I heard the testimony, and the jury should have focused on this fact, and this fact, and it would have outweighed what they obviously relied on to reach the other conclusion, and he didn't do that.
So if we decide that he misapplied the law under Blizzard, because as you pointed out during your opening argument, that he that his decision really focuses on the reckless conduct rather than on the duty issue, do we remand and have him do that?
No, it's just a reversal. He failed to meet the standard. The decision to grant the motion for new trial is simply reversed, and the verdict stands. For both the reasons, one, it's a question that this court can decide on the law that the standard was not met to grant a new trial. And then second, we have the practical difficulties associated with that. To send it back to Judge Stevens, he would be deciding it on a cold, or excuse me, to Judge Thompson, he would be deciding it on a cold record no different than what this court has. And I don't know where Judge Stevens is at. So I believe it's a reversal.
So, Mr. Angel, as a young judge, trial judge, I got a case that had been tried by my predecessor, Judge Bengtson, on a motion for a new trial that he granted, and it was sent back to me for a determination. It happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't get to say just because Judge Stevens is no longer available that we then say we reverse because he's not available. We send it back to the trial judge who's there.
It's tough. I understand. And that's difficult because then what we hope the trial judge is able to do is listen to those witnesses and make sure the juries don't get way off track. And so much of that, you've all been district judges, so much of that is being in the courtroom and feeling the vibe of what's going on.
What do you mean by getting off track?
Reaching a decision that's against the clear weight of the evidence.
How would the judge possibly know that until the verdict came in? I mean, the judge is listening to the trial, he's listening to the objections, the judge doesn't get to make objections. The record basically, at least should be, in principle, created by the attorneys. The judge has no idea if the jury is being led astray, really, until they reach their verdict, does he?
I mean, if he's remaining neutral, yes. I think here he didn't, but yes, he should remain neutral to the end and not know that until the end. And I just think in this case, we've had a verdict that was a sound verdict, and that if we send it back on a new trial, it's just literally taking a shot in the dark that you might get a different result with a different jury. There isn't the evidentiary analysis to support sending it back for a new jury.
I want to give you a chance to have a shot at a question I asked Mr. Zeal earlier. You know, this case had a very hotly contested summary judgment motion that you brought, and summary judgment on the issue of duty as a trespasser was denied. The plaintiff didn't file a cross motion for summary judgment, making the tactical decision, well, we think this is a jury question. If they make that decision, is there anything about that procedurally that would have stopped them or put them in a position where it's unseemly for them now to say, well, we think the jury should decide it, but a different jury, because this one obviously got it wrong.
Right. I agree with that. That it appears to me to be nothing more than taking a stab to get another jury to try to get a different conclusion. And we shouldn't allow that as district judges. The only rare instances should be in situations where a district judge can articulate various facts on one side of the ledger that say this jury was just off. If I send it back on a new trial, it is more probable than not that a new jury is going to reach a different conclusion.
Mr. Zeal suggested, I don't think he said this directly, so I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he suggested that the evidence that came out in trial was perhaps stronger than it was during the summary judgment phase. If he implied that, would you agree with that, Ian?
No, there was zero evidence, zero notice that a trial would be in that park. Zero.
Did the evidence change from summary judgment phase to the trial phase? In other words, did your case get weaker during the summary judgment phase, or did everybody testify the way everyone thought they were going to testify during summary judgment?
Roughly, yes. And I felt that the other witnesses that did not testify at summary judgment, because summary judgment was really limited to the affidavits from the parties, the other witnesses that came in confirmed that there was no notice that would put the city. It would make the city reasonably anticipate the children would be in there. It simply confirmed the city's position as it got to trial. With that, I might just make one comment. I'd be remiss if I didn't just mention the medical bill issue. My interpretation of Judge Stevens' comments was we have medical bills. They get adjusted a little bit for Medicaid. Medicaid pays a big chunk, and what they were left with was $400 out of pocket. I understood Judge Stevens was going to let them offer. It may have been 15 total. He was going to let them offer 10. And that was the adjustment portion, not the paid portion of Medicaid. And those, in order to properly preserve that, you've got to offer those bills, have the judge actually rule on it at the trial. And then if he did exclude the Medicaid paid portion and only allowed the out-of-pocket portion, then Mr. Zeal would have properly preserved that for appeal on that issue. But I think you just misunderstood Judge Stevens' ruling on that. I don't have anything else. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, sir. Matters of advisement will render decision.